How are you guys doing tonight? This is great to be here. Was anyone here 3 years ago when I gave my presentation sitting down on a bench with my leg stuck out with a bag of ice on top of it? Yes, okay, I remember that. It was 3 years ago. I was with Dr. Galuza, and we were having a nice dinner, and I have to carry around these big, huge gamer laptops because of all the video work that we do. So the laptop weighs like 10 pounds, and you got the brick, that's another 5 pounds in the laptop, and I bent over to pick the thing up, and I tore my meniscus and tacoed the meniscus right underneath the kneecap. It was a horrible injury, so I sat here for a couple hours with that knee just throbbing. By the time I got home, I was it was not very fun. But I stuck it out, and I'm glad that I did. You guys have always been a wonderful audience. I love coming here because this is actually my last speaking trip before I bolt 2.5 hours down the road and go home tonight. So, I think I've spoken like 10 times in 3 days, something like this. The Alpha and Omega with Dr. Nicholas, he thinks I'm a lemon, and he just squeezes me like this, just like I'm going to get every drop out of this. So, but I'm excited tonight to share this topic with you guys because I want to just come right out and boldly say that the Native Americans lived here in North America for thousands of years, right? And we want to honor their history tonight because they, for years, recorded their history. They were interviewed about their histories all the way from about the 1550s all the way up to the late 1900s or so. They were interviewed about their histories when the European scholars came here. In fact, during the 1800s, when the European scholars came here, they're like, whoa, the Native American culture might be disappearing before our very eyes because all the wars that were going on and the famines and the tribal groups being pushed around and moved around to reservations and everything. So some people got kind of desperate, people from the Smithsonian and other places, and they said, we have to interview these people now before their history is lost. So they did that, and we bought every one of those books, and you can go find them digitally and everything else, and we scoured through it, and we noticed an amazingly interesting pattern in their histories. So who would, with me, would agree that if you've looked into Native American lore and history, sometimes it seems kind of mystical and mythical, right? Have you ever looked at Native American stories? And this is not a compliment, it's not a criticism, it's just an observation. Sometimes they're talking about the sky god doing stuff, or if I paint my body in a certain way, certain things are going to happen. Well, what that did to a lot of these scholars that came here that were recording their histories, because some of the Native American history and mythology was a little bit out there, they disregarded a lot of their stories. Threw the baby out with the bathwater, like, yeah, I'm not quite sure there was really thunderbirds. That's a neat story, because the Native Americans are sitting in the interview chairs or by campfires with these guys recording what they're saying on parchments, and the Native Americans would come out with these fantastic stories, like, yeah, there used to be these giant birds, and they would carry off our women and children to go eat them right up there in the nest. Or we'd be going down this river in a canoe, and there was a big, huge bird perched up there, and it would come down and swoop up the guys that were in the canoe and fly up to the bone cave and eat them. And these scholars were writing down these stories going, well, that's just crazy because it sounds mystical. But there was another problem with these European scholars. They were plagued by a Darwinistic worldview. A lot of these scholars recording down the Native American histories for the first time believed in Darwinism, lock, stock, and barrel. So when they would hear these stories from the Native Americans, like the thunderbirds would come down and grab some of their people, or when the Native Americans were continuously talking about this big creature called a naked bear or a big rump bear, they would just relegate it to myth. Because they were plagued by a Darwinistic worldview, and they're sitting there interviewing these Native Americans, well, thinking, well, we know these creatures don't exist because they died out in the Ice Age millions of years ago, so what this guy's telling me just can't be true. But when you go back and look at the original accounts of these European scholars who actually wrote down what they said and you give it validity, you guys wouldn't believe the stories that came out of these communities. They lived here for thousands of years. They did the dominion mandate, which is to, you know, to take control of the land and spread around and be fruitful and multiply. All these different tribes, millions of Native Americans were populated around here. They owned this land and they knew the history down cold, and they passed the history from generation to generation to generation by song and glyph and memory devices. Sometimes they would find a person in their tribe who was going to be a good historian, like the smart guy over there in the corner, right? And they would just say, hey, let's give the job to him. He's going to be our history keeper. Or sometimes they would call them wisdom keepers. Well, the thing is, these stories, there are 33 Native American tribes that we've been able to find so far that have legends and myth and lore about these things called the Thunderbirds. And many people have heard Thunderbirds, and some people think, well, is that just a car, and it's got to be a Ford, so it can't be very good. So many people have heard of the Thunderbirds, but they think, well, that's just some mystical thing, right? That's just some myth and lore, like the sky god or something like that. So they just disregard the story. But when you go back and read the original stories from 1699 forward, the natives that were talking to the Jesuits that were over here trying to do the mission work and the European scholars, many of these accounts, they would sit down and with the old guy by the campfire and say, and they would clearly say, there were giant birds that lived in my day or in my grandfather's day, and they would come down and attack our women and our children. And oftentimes they would say, no, they would leave the men alone, they're too heavy. But they were picking up our women and our kids and flying off with them. And these guys writing them the story is like, well, that's just got to be some Thunderbird, mythical god kind of idea. And the natives are like, nope, this stuff really happened. And they would even point to caves, and they would see how they killed them, and they would name that warrior's name that went out and killed them and clubbed these things to death, or had to go hunt them, or how they would go up to the mouth of the cave with a bunch of wood and sticks and burn the things out and smoke them out of their caves. There's many, many stories like that. And then you start digging more and more, and you look at there's eight different tribes along the eastern seaboard that all have accounts about this creature called the naked bear. Sometimes they would call it a furless bear or the big rump bear or the stiff-legged bear or the stiff gait bear. There's eight different tribes that all talked about this creature. When you look at their interviews, it got so tense with the European scholars that are trying to write down these stories and deal with them. In the 1930s, they were having scholarly wars back and forth with each other saying, we can't figure out what they're talking about, but they're not talking about it like it's a mystical creature. They're saying they were attacked by a giant furless creature that they didn't know any other way to name it but a bear. And they knew what bears were. They knew what grizzly bears were. They knew what black bears were. In fact, you guys, the Native Americans, they considered bears just a trip to the grocery store. They killed bears all the time for food, medicine, and tools. So, and they would use their skins for stuff. Bears were just a practical form of protein to them. And when you look at the stories, they're like, no, there was a giant creature that had poor eyesight, that had really good smell. It was naked sometimes except for a white fur of tuft on its back. It was huge, about the size of a bison. And they would describe this creature on and on and on, but the distinguishing characteristic, it was always furless. It never had much hair on the thing. So I talked with a friend of mine, Brian Thomas, at ICR, and I'm like, you know what? We've got to do something with this story because I've got tomes of stories about this. The Shawnee talk about, the Iroquois talk about it. They're sure they were attacked by this creature. So we started rifling through all the different species. What on earth can this be? And then we found it. I know for darn sure exactly what that creature was, and that's a bold statement, but hopefully by the end of this talk you'll understand this as well as the Thunderbirds. It was called the Diadon, and it was a giant wild boar. We know these creatures exist. You can go to museums all over North America today and see the fossils of a Diadon. It was called a hell pig, and it was a wild boar the size of a buffalo, up to 1,800 pounds. They lived during the Ice Age. Evolutionists will say, oh yeah, those things went extinct 15 million years ago. That's how they disregard them. But the native accounts are like, no, we buried the last one in the year 1790 along the Hudson River outside of present-day New York. That's the native accounts. And all the European scholars are just like, well, we can't figure this out. So this thing had a 3-foot-long skull and tusks that would hang out of its mouth this big. And has anyone been on YouTube and seen hunters attacked by a wild boar? Well, imagine being attacked by a wild boar that you had no chance of living. A wild boar the size of a buffalo, 6 feet high at the shoulders. That's what these natives consistently reported, and they described it over and over again. In fact, another account said, we had to shoot it with so many arrows that it wouldn't die until it looked like a porcupine. So you see these guys on YouTube now, and they've got these compound bows with a 95-pound draw with a razor trident tip on their arrow, and they'll go try to shoot a wild boar, and if you place the shot right, it'll drop within minutes, right? But the Native Americans are like, no, this thing, we had to make it look like a porcupine, and it would finally die. We put one of the most well-known naked bear accounts in our movie that we just showed over at the Redding Christian School. We probably will get to show that movie again before it comes out in theaters in May. But this is just a little teaser of what I want to cover a little bit tonight that talks mostly on Thunderbirds, but we're going to talk a little bit about the naked bear as well. But the profound thing to me as a Christian is it makes perfect sense that the natives would have known these creatures. Because look, if creation just happened thousands of years ago, then the flood is about 4,500 years ago. Well, what was on the ark? The Bible says, well, if it breathed air and it lived on land, it was on the ark, and God brought them to Noah in pairs, in seven pairs of some, and all the birds were included. So if all the birds and the land animals came to the ark and they get out on the mountains of Ararat and they start spreading around the world, then about 100 years after the ark lands, you have the Tower of Babel dispersion, and you have 70 different people groups going around the world. Well, guess what? The people and the animals are going to spread out everywhere. The Native Americans came down through the Bering Strait, and they started populating the western coast first and then started moving east. They lived here in the same time that these creatures that the evolutionists would say are Ice Age creatures. But the Native Americans were here when the mastodons were here, when the diadon, the naked bear creatures were here, and when the Pleistocene or the Ice Age giant birds were here. I'm going to show you three different species of birds today that are the most likely Thunderbird candidates that lived during the Ice Age. And it's no conspiracy. It's not a mystery. We know these birds existed because we have their fossil record. They're just not buried in dinosaur layers. They're buried in layers a little bit higher because they died during the Ice Age. But we have their bones today, and they're found all over North America. And some of these creatures had, the big ones, had wingspans up to 24 feet. A Pelagornis had wingspan up to 24 feet, weighed like over 50 pounds, and it could definitely fly down and swoop up some small kids. But the big one, the pterotorns, there are Ice Age pterotorn birds that had, they look like a big turkey vulture. You can go down in the La Brea tar pits and see some of their skeletal remains. Some of them had wingspans up to 20 feet, and they weighed 180 pounds. What would you guys do if you walked out to your car tonight and there's a 180-pound bird there, and it opens up its wings, and it's a 20-foot wingspan? Well, you know what? The Native Americans saw these things over and over and over again, and that's why the Thunderbird was so highly regarded in the tier of like their worship and prayer processes, because they knew what these bad things looked like, and they elevated them in their worship and in their prayer types of practices. So with that introduction, I'm going to give you guys some evidence tonight that they actually did live with Thunderbirds. We're going to also cover the naked bear, and we'll also look at some evidence for mastodons, that humans lived with mastodons as well. Okay, so let's just go in with that brief introduction. So our book table is over there, and our book table has a huge problem right now. There's too many books left on it. So when I book it back to Sacramento tonight, that table's got to be bare. Please grab the books, take them for your friends. They literally are free. There's a suggested $10 donation, but if you have a book over there that you like, please grab it and take it. Don't make me take it home tonight if you can. And we've got some books about the Thunderbirds over there as well. Let's see, about our ministry, I think you guys have probably heard this before, but we are a student-focused ministry. We have about 250,000 subscribers on YouTube, over 30 million views. Last month, we got 297,000 views on YouTube, so that's really the push that we do. We're also on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook. We have two different programs that are specifically designed for students. One's called Debunking Evolution that dismantles the evolution that's taught in high school biology and life science. And that's really for 5th to 10th graders. And then we've got another program more for high schoolers and college called The Seven Myths. And all those are available over there. You can get these assets free on our website as well. We've got books on gender, sex, and marriage. We've got books on Noah's flood and books about giants. I think that's a topic I covered here last time as well, called the Nephilim. So lots of different books and resources over there. Make sure if you just want to grab one, grab this Answers book, because it covers a lot of each one of these different topics. And our mobile app has been downloaded by over 100,000 people, and it plumbs into our leading YouTube video. So you can download that on Android or iTunes and get our Genesis Apologetics mobile app. I saw a gal once who went to a Phil Wickham concert where they actually advertised and promoted this our mobile app. And she walked past us at a trade show, and she kind of doubled back, and she brought up her phone to me and she says, "Is this your guys' mobile app?" And I said, "Yep, that's our ministry." She said, "Well, I heard about it at a Phil Wickham concert, and I downloaded it, and I just need to let you know it changed my life." I'm like, "Well, what do you mean?" She says, "I'm a biology student at UC Davis, and I was just getting buried with evolution teaching, didn't know where to turn, wanted to still keep believing in the Bible, grabbed your mobile app, and I've been clean and clear a creationist ever since." So it's great, great stuff. There's lots of video resources out there that we offer, ICR offers. There's lots of other good creation ministries out there, but our mobile app's a great place to start. Have you guys watched The Ark in the Darkness yet? By show of hands, who's watched that movie so far on Noah's Flood? Okay, maybe about a third of us. The rest of you have to go watch that, because we're going to go for 10 million people. 6.4 million people in America so far have watched that movie, well, actually around the world. In fact, on our YouTube channel, our number two view audience is in India. For some reason, they're consuming a lot of Christian content, which is great. But this movie is about 2 hours long. It's got some great animations to it. It's a good documentary about Noah's Flood. You can just go to noahsflood.com and watch that. Over 6 million views. Our movie that's going to be coming out, called Out of Babel, we just showed a full preview of this movie a couple hours ago at Reading Christian School. Probably won't get to do that again in a while, but just go to Out of Babel and you can learn more about that movie. And for this talk to work, you guys are going to have to sit under the authority of Scripture. So we're told in 1 Thessalonians, it says, "For this reason, we also thank God without ceasing, because when you received the word of God, which you heard from us, you welcomed it, not as if it was the word of men, but as it is in truth, the word of God, which also effectively works in you believe." So this is called a conditional promise of God. And if you want God's word to work effectively in you, you've got to approach it with reverence and authority. So I would just encourage all of us, even if you're skeptical about what I'm going to go over tonight, if it seems to fit with Scripture, give it a while to season and marinate, and it should have a great influence on your life. In about another month or two, we're going to have a movie, a short movie, like a 30-minute piece. It's going to come out on Thunderbirds. I'm only covering about a third of what's covered in that movie. There's lots more evidence about Thunderbirds, so subscribe to our channel. You can see when that comes out. Just by way of an evidence preview, I'm just going to pluck one of the many Thunderbird stories so you guys can see what's coming tonight. This is from, reported by Chief Corn Planter, who lived between 1752 and 1836. And he says that many Cayuga natives and Onondagas came to view this terrible carcass that they called the mosquito monster, which some guy found a way to kill. He says the body was larger than a bear's, and its wingspan was as large or as long as three men, so about 18 feet. Its talons were as long as arrows, and the monstrous beak was lined with sharp teeth. Another account of this mosquito monster's footprints was said to be bird-like and about 20 inches long, and they were able to follow its tracks for 330 feet. What on earth are they talking about? So they said that the tracks could be found south of Syracuse, where the Onondaga natives kept the tracks clear and fresh and open for display so they could show them off when people came over to go see it. So what are they talking about? A bird that's got an 18-foot wingspan, that's got the body the size of a bear, and it's got talons that were leaving prints that were the size of arrows. So Native American archery tackle works like this. The bow is typically 40 to 50 inches long, and the arrow is usually about half to two-thirds of the length of a bow, and they can draw it about half the length of a bow, and the arrow would usually stick out a couple inches. So we're talking about 18 to 20-inch footprints that this bird was leaving. So what on earth is going to leave 18 to 20-inch footprints? Sometimes back in the day, they would measure inches using the thumb-over-thumb method like this, so it might have been a little bit shorter, maybe 16 inches. But what are these guys talking about, this crazy bird here? So both accounts agree that these talons or prints were in the 18 to 20 inch range. Now, if they were left in mud, maybe they were only 14 or 15 inches, but when they were leaving the print, they were 18 to 20 inches long. Well, there is a flying bird that is buried in the Ice Age layers that we can have the fossils for today, and it had a 24-foot wingspan. The closest one to it today is a wandering albatross. Sometimes the record can get up about 11 feet, and it's got feet that are about 8 inches long that when smushed in the mud might be able to leave a 10-inch footprint. But that's only about half the size of the bird that's reported by these natives who called it the mosquito monster. So that's quite interesting. The largest recorded footprint from the rear foot of a pterosaur, which they call a pez, is about 14 inches, because we also believe that the Native Americans reported some of these creatures being bat-like and large and attacking people, which would put it in the pterosaur category. So in the rear foot of a pterosaur, because sometimes they would walk on all four, was about 14 inches, and when it would make a depression in mud, it could be maybe 16, 17 inches long as well. So maybe it could have been a pterosaur, and I'm going to show you some descriptions from these accounts as we go through this. But basically, it's an 18 to 20 inch footprint recorded by two different accounts in the 1800s. What on earth is going to do something like this with its talons, leave an 18 inch footprint in the mud that's as long as an arrow? That's just a very interesting account. That's one example. We've got like 20 more accounts, but I'm going to drill into six of them tonight. So the Bible's got the account that would explain this. Evolutionists can't explain this. In fact, you're going to see later how evolutionists are now stuck, because in the state of California, they discovered mastodon bones with human tools in 1992 when they were digging out a freeway in San Diego. And that really perplexed the evolutionists, because they're like, wait a second, mastodons were supposed to be 130,000 years old, and humans didn't get to North America until 13 to 20,000 years ago. So how on earth are we finding human stone tools buried with mastodon bones? Because they were using the tools to smash the bones to harvest the marrow. So already the evolutionary timeline is shot. It doesn't hurt us at all, because we know that the creatures were here at the same time as humans were. So, and if this is the case with the Bible talking about the worldwide flood and when and how and why it happened, and you've got these flying animals, well, they were created on day five and mankind took dominion over them, and then they were aboard the ark, of course it would have lived hundreds or in some cases thousands of years after the flood, and that's exactly what we see. If this is true, we're going to have a very, very clear echo or a ripple effect that's going to go on for thousands of years until we get to our time. Because in 2026, no one's even thought about a giant, massive bird flying around. But if you talk to the natives 300 years ago, they'd be like, oh yeah, my grandfather killed one of those things. But now we're at an echo stage. We're so far away from when these things were happening, they sound like a distant echo. So tonight, I want you to just consider these four numbers, 300, 30, 20, and 8. And these numbers are going to, they're revealed in our Out of Babel movie. We're going to have videos that talk about this. But the 300 number, so if you were to have coffee with someone, they're like, look, I don't believe your creationist timeline. We know Earth is millions of years old, and there's no way dinosaurs walk with man. That's crazy. Just remember these four numbers as talking points. The number one proof that evolutionists cannot get out of, and if you read this book, you would agree with me, Nick has wrote this book called Echoes of Ararat. In this book, he's documented 300 flood accounts from Native Americans. And when you read through his book, grab a highlighter and highlight some of the things, because you won't believe what's in there. A lot of the times these natives are talking about a flood account that sounds just like they ripped it off out of the Bible, but the accounts in many cases were documented before the natives even saw a Bible. They're talking about things like, yeah, there was a great man, sometimes they even call him a Nohi, which kind of sounds like Noah, and he was in a canoe with his family, and some accounts even say, yeah, before he found dry land, he had to let birds go when they would return with a twig. These are Native Americans talking about these stories that have a direct overlap with Scripture. So there's 300 of these accounts about a worldwide flood from the North American Native Americans, North and South America. We've got over 30 Thunderbird accounts documented in this book, 20 giant accounts from Native Americans and 8 Native American tribes that said, look, we fought this creature called a naked bear. We'll get into those more as we go. But here's the Tower of Babel. That's where it is today. You can see it's a ziggurat. That's just the base foundation. If we zoom up and away from the original Tower of Babel, each one of these yellow dots you see on your screen is a flood myth or legend from an original culture. So if we spin the globe and look over at like Vietnam and the Philippines and those different areas, we see, look at those clusters of all these different indigenous cultures that all have myths and legends about a worldwide flood. It's a worldwide phenomenon, and many of these counts are, they're not talking about, oh yeah, there used to be a little regional flood or a river overran its banks. They're talking about a worldwide flood, but just drill into America, look at this, hundreds and hundreds of flood accounts from the Native Americans, especially along the western coast as they came down the Bering Strait and went over there. You can see that they're depositing these stories in all their different cultures. So how on earth do you have 300 worldwide flood accounts if the flood really didn't happen? Because if these people came from the Tower of Babel and were all cousins by the 70 different language groups that were scattered at the Tower of Babel, we all would have carried the flood myths and legends with all of our different cultures. And that's exactly what these groups did. Well, what about the giants? Well, we've documented 885 accounts of giants buried just in North America by about 1,200 people that have reported over 3,000 giant skeletons between about the 1500s and 1930. And the natives knew about this. There's 20 different tribes that are like, oh yeah, we know about the giants. They were here before we got here. And a number of the accounts say they were 7 to 10 feet tall. And even more of the native accounts, even with tribes separated by states, said they were tall white guys with red hair. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what I'm just reporting what they said. And there's all kinds of tribes that talk about that. And each one of these little blue dots is where giant skeletons between 7 and 10 feet have been uncovered. So why did all that stuff happen? Why do we have all these skeletons if it's not true? Here's what some of the newspaper reports look like. You can go back and find these on newspaper databases and archaeological reports. This guy, Chris Leslie, has documented a giant skeleton found in each one of the 88 counties in Ohio. Ohio is just chuck full of these mound giants. And we talked a little about the naked bear, the furless bear. There's 8 different tribes that talk about that. Here's the 8 different tribes, the Seneca, the Cayuga, the Lenni Lenape, the Mohicans, the Shawnees. These are big tribes. And over in the other column, that's all the different names that they would call it. They had a name for bear. That's not the name for a bear. That's the godforsaken, oh my gosh, look out, it's the naked bear type of a name. So, or the big rump bear. And I found it interesting, why are all these 8 tribes that report this furless bear, this terrifying bear, why are they all clustered in the Northeast? Do you notice there's no California tribes that talk about this thing called the naked bear or the Plains Native Americans? None of these other tribes talk about it. It's always just this area. I wonder if there were some diadons that were left over from the flood, maybe 12 or 20 or 50 of them, that lived in these regions that did in fact harass the Native Americans. With a 3-foot-long skull and 1,800 pounds and a temperament like a wild boar, they could get away with whatever they wanted to get away with. Okay, so I'm going to show a quick clip of an explainer video that we're going to use in the theater before we play our Out of Babel movie that goes through some more of what I just covered and some other stuff about thunderbirds and naked bears. Okay, so is there a way we can dim the lights a little bit maybe? Thank you very much. Some of this will be redundant to what I just said, but some of it's new, and I think the graphics are helpful too. So let's see this.
33 tribes report thunderbirds.
There we go.
And
maybe
many
lights
of these
again.
Accounts aren't talking about mythical or spiritual thunderbirds, but rather actual flying creatures large enough to carry off their women and children, but not their men. This is exactly what we would expect based upon the maximum carrying capacities of Ice Age birds or pterosaurs. At least 8 tribes have a clear history of terrifying naked bear or big rump bear, which was nothing like the common bears they knew. These East Coast tribes clearly lived with the Deodon, a buffalo-sized wild boar that terrorized their people and was incredibly difficult to kill. They buried the last one along the Hudson River before 1790, why did these eight tribes consistently regard this creature as such a man-killer to be feared over bears and wild pigs that they harvested all the time for food, medicine, and clothing? And why did only East Coast tribes report this creature? If this was just some mythical creature, why does it happen to fit a deodon so well? Natives described it as hairless or naked, having a big rump on its back, sometimes with a tuft of hair, bad eyesight, but a great sense of smell, and a stiff gait. Early American scholars feuded in the literature, trying to figure out just what kind of creature the natives were reporting. But they missed it because they were committed to an evolutionary viewpoint that placed these creatures millions of years before man. But the natives knew exactly what they were talking about. Even today, the evolutionary view of such Ice Age creatures interacting with man is being upended. Just in 1992, highway construction workers in San Diego uncovered mastodon bones and tusks along with hammer, stone, and anvil tools used by humans to smash the bones and extract marrow for food. The problem? The mastodon bones were supposed to be 130,000 years old, and humans were believed to arrive in the Americas just 13,000 to 20,000 years ago. So, what are they doing hunting mastodons over 100,000 years earlier? The truth is that Ice Age and dinosaur-era creatures like pterosaurs, massive flying birds such as pterotaurs, and giant boars like deodons lived alongside man, and they came here after the flood just a few thousand years ago. The natives knew this, and they called them thunderbirds and naked bears. These claims are supported by our books and videos, and of course, our movie, Out of Babel.
Okay, great. That's just a quick overview introduction. Let's keep going here. We're going to explore now by looking at four different myths about Thunderbirds. The first myth is, well, there's lots of pictures online about humans with pterosaurs and giant birds, and they're all just fakes. That's the first myth. The second myth is that, well, there's no way that birds, giant or not, could swoop down, pick up, and fly away with a human, man, woman, or child. Myth number three is, sure, Native Americans had myths and stories about giant birds, but these were all just metaphors used for storytelling. And myth four is, sure, maybe there were giant birds that lived during the Ice Age, but these went extinct long before humans even existed or before they lived in the Americas. Let's look at the first myth. So the first myth is, there are lots of pictures online of humans with pterosaurs or giant birds, and these are all just fakes. Well, that's actually true. That's a true myth. Has anyone seen this picture before? It made its way along the internet. It looks exactly like a pterodactyl. They got the anatomy really, really good. And it says livery feeds and stable up there. And it looks, got these old pioneer guys, and they're holding up this thing. It looks like they killed the pterosaur. Well, it was done based upon an account that may or may not be true. But here's a newspaper account. These guys reported seeing what looked like a large flying bat in 1890s. So they report seeing a pterosaur-like creature. So what this guy did, this artist, is tried to make a graphic that would have gone along with that story, but it went around the internet as a real pterosaur, but it was not. Has anyone ever seen this? The Civil War pterosaur picture. This one's also fake. You can look at the two ends of the wing, and they just took it in Photoshop and just exchanged the wing there. It's actually the same wingtip on both sides, but it looks pretty good. You got these Civil War guys sitting there with their muskets, and it looked like they shot down this big pteranodon, but that's also fake. But these are not fake. All through America, the Native Americans were making petroglyphs and carvings and myths and legends about giant birds. And if you look at some of these petroglyphs, well, they're pecking at humans with their big beaks there. And this other thunderbird down here is about to pick up some form of a mammal, coyote or a deer or something like that. And this other one, that's from Turkey. In the middle there, there's a large bird that's dismembering a couple of guys. What's going on with that? And of course, we have Quetzalcoatlus that the Aztecs and the Mayans have in their literature. And then they're like, well, that's a giant flying reptile. That's what they viewed, how they viewed Quetzalcoatlus. And then Alaska, we have these giant thunderbirds coming down and picking up big fish and sometimes deer. So this is just a sampling. There's all kinds of examples of pterosaur pictures and cave drawings and things like that. Okay, so let's look at myth number two. Well, there's no way that birds, giant or not, could swoop down, pick up, and fly away with a human, man, woman, or child. So let's look at that myth. Well, to start, there are eagle species alive today that weigh 15 to 25 pounds. There's three of the larger species that are well documented to carry actually more than half of their weight. And I have a couple of examples. It's the golden eagle, the harpy eagle, and the African crowned eagle that are known for having the highest prey-carrying weight capacities. So here's a golden eagle, and it landed on a fox. And it's going to get some lift from the wind, but there it goes. Off with a fox, probably equal to its body weight, but it got some wind left. But look at this thing flying away with a fox. Very well documented. And there's also instances of these things carrying away goats, small goats, about 1 year old, but they'll fly down and they'll grab them, carry them for a little bit, and then drop them. And some of the talons of these things are bigger than human hands, bigger and stronger than human hands. So if a 15 to 25 pound eagle can do it, can easily carry half of its weight, what could a 186 pound pterotaur do? Maybe carry 80 pounds? Well, let's see. I think this is an African crowned eagle. Here's a tribe that shot one down. You can see how big these creatures are, and look at the size of those talons, just huge, huge animals. So, well, here's some examples of some of those large Ice Age birds I was telling you about, the Aragornis or Pelagornis or the Argentavis magnificens. These birds weigh between 51 and 174 pounds with wingspans between 16 feet and 24 feet. But if you just look at the one on the end there on the far right side, that's the biggest one, and it probably had a calculated maximum carrying weight of 87 pounds. The bird was 174 pounds, and that's as much as it could weigh, had a 22-foot wingspan, was absolutely capable of human predation, carrying small people, 50, 60, 70 pounds. And a Pelagornis was lighter. It wasn't as heavy as a bird, but it had a 24-foot wingspan. A lot of these birds will make use of their weight and the flight physics coming down really fast, and they'll snatch up their prey to make the physics a little bit easier on them. But yes, you look at these birds, and you're like, well, certainly they could possibly carry humans, and these things are all buried in the Ice Age layers. Here's what some of them look like. Here's an artist's rendition of one swooping down to go fight with a saber-toothed tiger. Here's a life-size replica that was in the L.A. County Museum of a pterotaur. That's how big they really would be. Here's an animation of one with a 20-foot wingspan coming down to grab a deer. Stuff like this would have definitely been possible, especially if you've got eagles that can carry half of their weight. That might be a third of its weight. But that type of thing was definitely possible. Here's what one might look like with a 20-foot wingspan spread out in front of a Native American woman. You can see how big those wingspans would be. And again, this is not conjecture. We know these birds lived. They fill the fossil record. They're there in the fossil record. The big question is, when did they live? And according to the Native Americans, they lived along with them at the same time. So what about the massive birds species that are found in the, quote, dinosaur-bearing layers? Now we're talking about pterosaurs. Well, first of all, we just have to eradicate the idea that these birds, these pterosaurs, evolved. That's an impossibility, because here's a leading expert of pterosaurs in the world. This guy's famous. Dr. Carl Werner interviewed him, and he's like, look, he just comes right out and admits, we know very little about the evolution of pterosaurs. The ancestors are not known, and when the pterosaurs first appear in the geological record, they were completely perfect. They were perfect pterosaurs. So they have no idea where the ancestors of the pterosaurs come from, and they have no progression. They have no transitional species. When they dig them up out of the dirt, they're just perfect pterosaurs. So they definitely didn't evolve. And when we find them in the flood record in the deposits. Do you know that they're found throughout the entire Mesozoic? They're found in the Jurassic layers really deep, the Triassic layers below, and then the Jurassic, then the Cretaceous. These birds are found buried all throughout the fossil record, and that's because they got airborne during the flood and flew around for as long as they could before they finally bought it, got tumbled up, couldn't fly anymore, and they're buried and scattered throughout the world. And that's exactly what we would expect by Noah's flood. So here's what the largest pterosaurs would have looked like. They range between 350 and 550 pounds. The biggest ones, like the Quetzalcoatlus and the other one that's, I'm not even going to try to pronounce the name, Hatzegopteryx, there we go, 550 pounds of weight. How do you fly when you're a 550-pound bird with 38-foot wingspans? Well, some people have tried to estimate how these creatures could have flied, and they've determined that a pterosaur with a 35-foot wingspan would need 16-mile-an-hour winds in today's earth pressures just to get lift, just to get its toes up off of the ground. So if they did live in a post-flood world, and we believe that they did, they were probably constrained using their four legs that they could walk around on. They kind of had this little crawl-hop thing that they could do, and probably leveraged a lot of caves and a lot of thermals. They would probably have to hike up to the top of a cliff, do their thermal thing, and try to land back up there, and if not, they could walk back up, because they could actually walk quite proficiently. Their rear legs looked like feet. They called them the apes. But these things probably had less weight-carrying capacity, maybe about a third of their weight. The biomechanics are different when you have a bat-like wing membrane. You have less lift than if you have feathers. But these creatures were fully capable of carrying people. And the Native Americans, in at least two accounts that are very descriptive, described their Thunderbird as a pterosaur. One account said, after we killed it and it landed, we inspected it and it had four wing joints. Do you know that no other birds besides pterosaurs have four wing joints? Why would a Native American, after killing a pterosaur, want to report, yeah, it had four wing joints? Amazing that they would have to do that. So I'm quite convinced that these creatures lived with humans. Here's a Quetzalcoatlus. You can size it up. You can see how they walk like that. They can walk on their wings with their four joints going on. And when they would spread their wings out, they're like a sail. Well, here's one next to a human. You know, 36-foot wingspan, some of these things. Just huge, huge creatures. So myth number three is that these 30 Native American tribes had myths and stories about giant birds, but these were all just metaphors for storytelling. Well, that's partially true, but also very incorrect. The truth is, these 30 Native American tribes had myths and stories about giant birds, and some of them were based on actual large flying creatures, so they became revered as legend, myth, and storytelling. The reason why the Thunderbird became such an elevated creature in their mythology and their prayers and their religious practices is because they were based on the original true pterosaurs that they used to do combat with in many cases. So that's why they were so famous in their histories. So I don't have time to go through all the different pterosaur images and everything, but my challenge is this. Go find a Native American totem pole of any tribe that doesn't have a Thunderbird head on it. Most of them do, and it's because they were highly revered. But you've got Quetzalcoatlus, a big flying reptile that would eat the Mayans and the Aztecs. You've got these guys wearing Thunderbird hats. You've got the Piazza bird account, which we feature in our movie. Many people are going to see the Piazza bird account that we feature in our movie, and they're going to immediately disregard it. My gosh, you've got this huge pterodactyl, and it flies down. It tries to grab a chief, and then you've got 20 of these warriors out with poison-tipped arrows. We modeled the Native American story really, really well, and they're going to look at this and just go, well, that's crazy. Well, my challenge to skeptics is just one thing. Why is it that with respect to this Piazza bird account, two professional scientists went up and inspected the legend cave where this bird was supposed to live and where it perched before it would fly down and snatch up the guys in the canoes? They went up there and they had to use climbing poles like they use in the Alps to go up and access what they called this bird cave or bone cave. It's all been demolished now because they quarried the whole area for limestone. But the two different guys had access and they got up there. You know what they found on the inside? Human bones mixed with animal bones. And when you start thinking through this, it's case closed. It had to be a bird. Think about it. It took these guys a whole day on different occasions to access the cave. They had to use climbing poles to get up inside of it, so it was really hard to access. And show me a Native American tribe through history that was willing to throw grandma's skeleton in a cave with a bunch of animals. Native Americans never did that. They were ritualistic in their burial practices. They were religious about their burial practices. They either burned their dead or ceremonially buried their dead. They would never go throw them in a cave, especially in a cave with a bunch of animals. But these two professional researchers that went up to Bone Cave were like, yeah, I was up to my knees in bone remains from humans and animals. It has to be some type of a big bird that had access to this cave that was going down and getting its prey and bringing it back and eating it. To me, I found that very, very convincing. There's other reasons too, but all throughout history, you can see even to this day, Native American ceremonies, they revered this thunderbird. So with that, let's see if we can kill the lights again, and we're about to get into Randy's time here, so I'll try to end in just about 10 minutes, Randy. I've got one clip I want to close this up with. There's no way I could talk my way through 6 Native American Thunderbird accounts, but I want to just show you guys a preview clip of our Thunderbird movie, because it goes over 6 of these different accounts in a pretty rapid-fire fashion, and let's give this a go.
The Inuit have a rich Thunderbird history, with carvings and icons everywhere, including Thunderbirds attacking large fish or even deer. One Inuit Thunderbird account, documented by the Smithsonian in the 19th century, tells about the last pair of Thunderbirds that lived on a mountaintop near Sabot Niski, overlooking the Yukon River. The natives called it Tira Matikpuk, meaning the Great Eagle, and claimed that these massive eagles preyed on large fish, deer, and even humans by looking down upon the village near the water's edge and swooping down on fishermen in their canoes and carrying them back to their young in the nest. The natives claimed that fishermen would be eaten by the young thunderbirds and the canoe would lie bleaching among the bones and other refuse scattered around the perimeter of the nest. After this went on for years, only the most daring would go upon the great river in view of the birds. One summer day, a young hunter lost his wife to one of the birds that swooped down and carried her away to the nest. The hunter pursued, found the nest, and killed the young birds and then the two adults. The author testified that the natives regarded this story as more than just myth, but a real account that could be validated by inspecting the human bones and ribs of old canoes at the nest site. The natives of the area even have carvings of these thunderbirds swooping down on large fish and reindeer. Henry Schoolcraft documented a Dakota thunderbird account in the 1850s where natives killed a thunderbird in Little Crow's village on the Mississippi River. It was reported to have a face like a man, a nose like an eagle's bill, and a long, slender body. Its wings had 4 joints to each, which were colored in zigzags, representing what they believed to be lightning. The back of its head was red and rough, resembling a turkey. How could they know the anatomy of a pterosaur with such detail if they did not actually see one? In fact, a 4-jointed wing is exactly how a pterosaur wing would be described, along with the featherless face with large eyes, making it more similar to a human's face than the face of a feathered eagle. With joints, soft tissues like eyes, and colors intact, it seems like they were looking at a freshly killed pterosaur, not making up a story about a fossil. A similar Dakota account was recorded by Hanford Gordon in 1881, where a thunderbird was killed near Kapsa by the son of Seton Wakawa Mani, and they named the place after the creature, calling it Wakinian Tanga, Big Thunder. An 1898 Apache Thunderbird legend records a giant raptor that devoured men, women, and children that was hunted and finally killed by a brave warrior. The historian claimed that the account could be verified by inspecting the actual wing of the monster bird that was of enormous size, with bones as large as a man's arm, and fragments that were still preserved at Taos. 2 Yaqui elders from Sonora recount the following story of an enormous bird that preyed on humans during a time before their generation.
Long ago, men, women, and children were carried off by a giant bird of prey with huge talons that lived on the slopes of Otamkawi, called Skeleton Mountain, in the foothills of the Sierra Madre Occidental above the Rio Yaqui. In those days before pueblos, the Yaquis lived in crude shelters made of mud and branches, cowering in constant fear of the dreadful bird. Every evening, someone was carried off toward Skeleton Mountain. On the hillside, villagers found great heaps of bones and skulls of the victims. The bird was impossible to kill, for it had very keen eyesight and soared very high. A young orphan decided to hunt down the fiendish raptor. An old man who lived near Skeleton Mountain advised the boy to hide near the bone piles to ambush the bird. The boy set off with his bow and arrows. He dug a hole in the bone field and hid, then ambushed the creature and finally killed it with a club. They claimed that the bones of the terrible bird remained on the hillside to present day. After the boy returned to his village, he defended his account by promising, "You can cut my neck if the story is not true." The boy then led a party of elders and warriors from 8 villages to see the proof of the pit he had dug and the bird's skeleton. When the men and soldiers saw the bones of the big bird, they went away contented. The villagers rejoiced, no longer having to worry about danger from above.
This account was independently confirmed by a very similar story from Ruth Giddings in Yaqui Myths and Legends. This account includes the same basic elements. A great bird that hunted humans generated enough fear among the tribespeople that they did not have outside gatherings and people living in shelters designed to protect against the great bird. She also reports the bird being killed by a young brave who lost his family to this bird. On February 12, 1699, Captain Juan Mateo Manji and Jesuits Eusebio Francisco Quino and Adamo Gil recorded in their travel diary that the Pima Indians who lived around the Sonora Desert reported that a giant monster lived in a nearby cave until just recently. The natives reported that the monster would fly around and catch as many of their people that it could eat. Their diary records, "One day, after the creature had eaten its fill, some Indians followed it back to its cave. When it was sound asleep, they closed the entrance of the cave with wood collected for this occasion, then set it on fire. The creature couldn't escape, and growling fiercely, died as it was asphyxiated by the flames and smoke." The Pima also report a story where they killed a similar creature in the pueblo of Apasura using the same strategy. General Don Hernando Cortez reports sending these bones to Spain.
Very, very interesting. That was just 6 accounts of the maybe 30 that we've been able to identify. So let me wrap up here, and I'm going to hand the toggles over to Randy, but we'll look at the last myth. So myth 4 says, sure, maybe there were giant birds that lived during the Ice Age, but these went extinct long before humans even existed or before they lived in the Americas. Well, here is the report that came out on CNN. This was out on about 12 different news wires. We've got about 6 of them we're going to play through our movie. But in 1992, the evolutionary timeline died in the state of California because these museum scientists, several of them were willing to put their credibility on it. They're like, yep, we can't explain this. We have confirmed human tools that were used for harvesting marrow and bones in mastodons buried next to these bones in the same strata, same layer. There's no way they can get out of it. So this fits a biblical timeline perfectly, but it doesn't fit the secular view. In fact, it absolutely goes against the secular view. The biblical view is that humans were in America after Babel some 4,000 years ago, and the Native American history agrees with that biblical history. Mankind lived with Ice Age animals like thunderbirds and naked bears just thousands of years ago. So if we look at what these Native Americans were living with, they lived with mastodons, probably giant sloth, the diadons, and of course, thunderbirds. They lived along with these creatures. And for me, all this does is it's external evidence that's very, very thorough from all kinds of different citations and lots of books that does nothing for me but confirm the Babel account and the dispersion that's recorded in the Bible. And it also confirms for me a young earth that completely aligns with the biblical timeline of creation and flood just thousands of years ago. So I will wrap up there, guys. But before we give it over to Randy, can I take a couple of questions before we do a transition of speakers? Any questions I can help you guys out with? Yes. Yes, so if you make an honest look through the sediment layers, like just in North America, you'll generally, not always, but generally find a distinction. Like if you go to Montana, you're going to find what's called the Cretaceous layers, which represent some of the final zenith levels of the flood. We believe the flood went up higher than some of those levels, and ICR's team has done a ton of research on that. We've got the last sequences where the flood was flooding off and everything, but some people would put the flood boundary at there. We go a little bit higher along with ICR, but we know that dinosaurs stopped being buried at a certain level, and there are some places you can go where you see the dinosaur fossils stop with layers of mud on top of them. Then on top of that, with like in Alaska, some places like with the tundra and everything, you'll find a second set or families of types of creatures like mastodons and the Pleistocene birds, some of these Ice Age birds. So there is a clear distinction, generally speaking, where you're going to have dinosaur layers like in America that go up to a certain point. Then sometimes you'll have some more sediment layers. Then you'll have the ice age layers on top of that. In some cases, they're mixed up. In fact, I've been to places where they've got layers that they say are Jurassic, like early dinosaur, on top of Cretaceous layers. So it's not as clean as they make it out in books, but generally speaking, you will find in some cases where you have certain types of bones that are buried on top of the layers where we stop seeing the dinosaurs. So that's what I mean by the Ice Age layers. So, yes. Would it have to do with density? Yes. Animals during the flood were buried by their smarts and their body density and their mobility. Those are the three biggest factors that determine which animals are buried where. But there are places in America where you can see burials that were probably flood or could have been Ice Age related things, where you're generally going to find certain types of animals that are not going to be buried with your traditional Cretaceous dinosaurs. Like you're going to find like giant sloths, saber-toothed cats, diodons, and things like that, usually found together in similar areas, and you don't ordinarily find those creatures with the dinosaur creatures. It's a pretty consistent finding. So, yes. Can Thunderbird what? Caves. You know, I would say that there's a lot of unexplored caves around. Personally, from the research that I've done, I think the Thunderbirds and Diodons all were gone by about the 1600s. That's where my smell test would be. There's one place, Papua New Guinea. If you were to hop an airplane right now and fly to Papua New Guinea and just rock up to the natives there and say, hey, tell me about, you guys ever see anything strange flying up in the sky? They're like, oh yeah, the ropin. The Native America or the natives in Papua New Guinea have a very consistent, very matter of fact, oh yeah, there's a ropin that flies around. It's a big, huge creature, like 6 to 10 foot wingspan, and sometimes only comes out at night. They have a very consistent telling about the ropin creature. And then when you take two of the guys that said that they saw it together and you put them in different rooms, they've done this before, they will give you exactly the same description of what they saw. It's pretty amazing. So I would say if there's anywhere left in the world where we have flying pterosaurs or thunderbird-like creatures, that's where I would put my money, but I think most of them are gone. Especially in North America, I think they're gone. I don't think we'll find any more caves. But in the 1990s, there was a rumor mill going around that some Native Americans had a big feather that had veins in it that were the size of chalk. So you're always going to get those scrappy rumors and everything, but from our research, from the Native American accounts themselves, they would report that, yeah, it lived there a while ago, or in my grandpa's day, or whatever. They're usually referring back to, you know, before the 1600s. Good question. Yes. Yeah, they were definitely brought on the ark, and then they spread around and reproduced, and then they started living in habitats that were friendly enough to provide food sources for them. So definitely aboard the ark, as were the dinosaurs. They spread around, and most of them probably went. If you look at the dinosaurs that were on board the ark, there are probably 80 different types or varieties of dinosaurs at the family level. I believe most of those were extinct you know, within probably hundreds or maybe 1,000 or so years after the flood. But pterosaurs and the raptor type, which could include the T-Rexes and everything like that, those types of bodies seem to be very, very similar to the dragon accounts that are frequently reported by most cultures around the world. So, good. Maybe one more question before we wrap up. Yes. Yes, good question. She asked, if dinosaurs were on the ark, would they have eaten some of the people? So let's remember that in the beginning, Genesis 1 says that the animals were designed just to eat vegetation. Then after the fall, animals turned against each other, and carnivorism was probably at its peak before the flood. We know this because we have evidence of animals even during the flood fighting and eating each other and finding them in each other's stomachs and things like this. On the ark, it was a 371-day flood process. They definitely brought food and probably fresh water. Of course, you've got to have the fresh water on board the ark. And I believe that the Bible says that God brought the animals to Noah. He didn't have to go round them up. So if there was a supernatural event for God to draw all the animals to the ark to get on board the ark, when they're in the ark, it's entirely possible that they would have gone into a very calm, meditative state, just like when your dog gets in a car, they go to sleep. There's a good possibility that a lot of these animals went into like a kind of a hibernation state when they were on board the ark. It's a good possibility. We'll never know. We know it didn't record anything like that, but that's entirely plausible that they went into a state of slow or mild hibernation. But if animals could survive before the flood just eating vegetation, they didn't have to eat meat while they were on board the ark. Even today, a great white shark can survive just on kelp. You've got fruit bats that just eat fruits, but they've got terrible-looking teeth and things like that. So yeah, they could definitely just eat vegetation. All right. Let me do that one last enthusiastic question back there. Yes. Did the natives eat the Thunderbirds? You know, I'm going to say that generally speaking, the Native Americans regarded some types of animals as food sources, like deer was a commodity to them, and other animals they didn't want to eat. And so I would be surprised if they ever got into hunting Thunderbirds for food. That would surprise me. Yeah. Good. You guys are great. Thank you very much for tonight. All right.